Hello, welcome to Think Digital, Act Human, a podcast from the Department for Education where we tell you everyday stories of digital and technology specialists working on extraordinary projects. But today, we've got a big one for you. We have an external guest and a brilliant one at that. Welcome to Clara Griot.
Thank you, Zoe. Lovely to be here.
So we know that you're a previous civil servant, so you kind of know what it's like on this side of the microphone, I suppose.
That's right. I was at GDS, Government Digital Service, for eight or nine years.
And what do you do now?
So at the moment, I've just had a baby, so I'm on sort of mat leave, but I have been running some training courses in service design.
Okay, so you are a service design expert, but one of the main reasons that we're talking to you today, apart from you're wonderful, Clara, you're a very nice person to talk to, apart from that, we know that you're also someone who is, how can we say this, someone who enjoys talking to employers, enjoys talking to the public about the importance of, what, diversity? Like, what would you say?
Yeah, I think so. Well, so when I was a lead designer at GDS, so we had a design community of, I think it was over 30 designers by the end of my time there. And when I joined, it was all white men who knew each other. This was sort of 2014. And then slowly became slightly more diverse over the years. And then in the last few years, we really decided to ramp up that move towards becoming a more diverse community. And that's because more diverse teams build better services. That's one reason. It makes for a more enjoyable place to be for everyone if it isn't just a monoculture and everyone looks the same and knows each other. It's just a more fair and equitable way to be an employer. So everybody should have an equal chance of working as a designer at GDS or working anywhere. And we wanted to try and make that a bit more of a reality in our design community. And we know that there are a lot of underrepresented groups in design, in the design industry, in tech in general. And we wanted to sort of start doing something about that and to do that by leading by example, really. So we looked into why we weren't matching, why our demographics weren't matching the demographics of the public that we served, and then try to address those problems as we saw them coming up.
It does feel like the whole conversation about diversity and inclusion has become more equity. You know, like whenever I think of equity, I think of this, it's like a well-known graphic of some people looking over a fence. One of them super tall and has no problem just looking over the fence. And then like two of them are of like, one's middle height, one's kind of like much shorter. And the idea is if you all stand on boxes, which is equality, you've all got the same box. Yeah, two of them are okay, but that shorter person still can't see over the fence. Whereas if it's about equity, ensuring people have like the same experience, then the tallest person doesn't need a box. The middle person needs only one box, and the shortest person with two boxes, they're all kind of able to see over the fence.
I love that graphic, and I particularly love an update to that where I've seen the people are all the same height, but they're starting from different positions on the ground. So it's like a stepped thing on the ground, and that represents the historical oppression and sort of marginalization of people. And then the fence is also sloped upwards. So the fence is working against people. So, and I think I like that version, which represents, sorry, the present day sort of systems of oppression and exclusion. And I like that because it's not about, oh, you're tall and you're really short and it's your fault that you're short and then we have to give you three boxes. It's like, no, the ground I'm standing on is lower and the fence is higher. I've got higher barriers than you do. Yeah. So it's a good one. Anyway, sorry, that's not why we're here.
No, that's a really, I'm going to have to check that out and see if I can find that graphic.
I'll find a few, yeah. I run another training course called Power and Privilege in Design, which is sort of part of the whole educating in user-centered design thing. And we talk about that one a lot.
So before we dig into this idea of recruiting in a way that is equitable and recruiting diverse candidates, but that are, I suppose, diverse compared to the people you usually recruit. Let me just ask you about user-centered design, because there may be some people thinking, well, if I'm designing a product, isn't all design user-centered?
By default, I think the tech industry and government tends towards not being user-centered. We tend to be either policy-centered, so centered around what a minister, for example, has promised to deliver or what a policy team has decided we need to deliver, or we tend to be tech-centered. So we have a piece of technology that does a thing, so we're going to deploy that in some way, regardless of what impact that has on people. So whether it's AI or a web chat or a new, just any kind of new piece of technology, it's often centered around the tech and what the tech can do and what we can build it to do, rather than on users and people and what they're trying to do and what they need to support them to do the things they're trying to do. So user-centered design is all about how do we understand and engage with users and communities and what they're actually trying to do, and then how do we make sure we create products and services that helps people do those things.
As a product manager, I am understanding that struggle. So I think if you're in the private sector, if you work like a startup, you probably have maybe some founders or co-founders who are finding a little bit hard to let go of those reins, and you know, it's kind of maybe founder driven but then in
idea centered.
And then in the public sector, I think that is a real key difference. It's not just are you trying to drive revenue or not, but there's also this, where is the kind of momentum coming for this work coming from? And when you work in the civil service, you may have a brand new minister who's like coming in, making promises for what they'd like to help the public. And then eventually that comes down to your team and you're like, oh, right, OK, let's just check whether this is actually a problem that anyone's having. So, yeah, very interesting.
Absolutely. And I think that's the reason I'm drawn to the public sector, is because in the private sector, it's a bit more of a difficult argument, because you have to justify why being user-centered will mean you make more money, usually. But in the public sector, one of the reasons for public services existing, so whether it's central government or local government or NHS or whatever it is, those organizations exist to serve users. So if you're not meeting user needs, you're not doing the thing that your organization is there to do. So it's kind of an easier argument to have with people to just say, we have to be user-centered because that's why we're here. That's the point of government.
So let's talk about this idea of recruitment and why it's important for employers to even think about diversity in terms of the types of people they're getting in the door. Because you see, people who've listened to the show will know that I am originally a Devon girl, and I used to be a journalist back in the day, and there were people who I'd talk to, employers, and they'd say things like, we really want to have diverse staff, but we just can't seem to recruit people who come from diverse backgrounds. Like maybe the diversity isn't there in the population we're advertising to, or maybe they just don't hear about these things or whatever. But it was really interesting, a tweet that you made where you where you were saying, Clara, are you wondering where to advertise roles to get more diverse candidates to apply? Try running a careers event. The problem isn't that we're not finding out about the job, it's that we have questions and concerns that aren't being addressed. So that's like flipping the whole thing, isn't it? Could you start by talking a bit more about how people who would like to hire more diverse candidates, how they can go about doing that with this careers event idea or anything else, any other advice you have?
Yeah, sure. So I don't think the problem is that people who are more diverse than your current organization is made up of aren't hearing about the jobs. I think that's where a lot of people go to. It's like, oh, we need to publicize it. We need to get on the right job boards or whatever it is, get on the right Twitter accounts. And then suddenly all of these black and brown people and LGBTQ people will suddenly apply for our jobs. I don't think that's what we're doing wrong. I think it's unfortunately more systematic things that are stopping us from having a more diverse and equitable workforce. So things like, is there something about your recruitment process that is excluding people? So often, if is it the criteria that you are scoring people on? Is it the way you've framed your job specification, the things that you've asked for, the words that you've used in the job specification? Is it the reputation of your organization? I mean, people talk to each other. People aren't silly. We ask people that we know what different places are like to work in. If your organization just isn't being a very good place to work in, or isn't safe for people with minoritized identities to exist in, or isn't a good place to progress in and thrive in, then people aren't going to want to work there. Which is that's not an easy problem to solve. I'm not pretending it is, but these are some of the reasons that people either might not be applying or might not be getting through your application process.
So how would a careers event help in that circumstance then?
The careers event is something that we ran a few times when I was at GDS, the Government Digital Service, and we ran, I think, about five careers events, some were in person, some were online. And I think one of the main things they did was turn GDS, our organization, into people. So our Government Digital Service is quite a sort of a well-known organization across the tech industry. And I think there's a lot of myths and kind of misunderstandings about what that organization is. And I think one thing that the careers events did was just turn us into people that you could ask questions of and that you could have a conversation with and that were like you. And we would just talk to people, answer their questions, tell them a bit about what our day was like. And a lot of people would come up to us after the event and say, oh, it was just really nice to put a face to this organization, or to talk to a real person, or to, you were all so friendly, or you seemed to get on with each other and you seemed to be friends when different people were presenting different things and talking to each other. And that was really nice. And it just makes the organization feel more human. I think that was sort of one of the biggest sort of non-tangible things it did, as well as answering lots and lots of basic questions like, how do I apply, which you've already talked about. What does a day look like? What does career progression look like? What are you doing to improve the equity and diversity of your organization? People would ask some really difficult questions, and it wasn't always easy to answer them. But I think just the fact that we were open to hearing those questions and trying to answer them is important.
So we've heard about this idea of a careers event, which could be a way of making your organization seem more approachable, less intimidating, less sort of, wow, that's not the type of place where I could get in, to just like opening the doors and letting people see what it's all about and who the people are and what how they work and that sort of stuff. Do you have one last piece of advice before we go about how what every employer could do to make their recruitment better in terms of attracting and then potentially hiring on more diverse staff members?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to listen to what your existing staff are telling you and what your prospective staff are telling you, and listen to their concerns, their questions, their worries, and then try and genuinely address some of those issues. And I know that a lot of the issues will be big things that it will feel difficult to change or difficult to do anything about, or maybe it'll take a long time, or maybe they won't be, maybe they'll be small things. But if you really listen to what people's concerns are and then show that you are genuinely working on improving those things, then people are much more likely to trust your organization, trust the leadership of your organization, and want to work there or want to stay employed there. I think retention is another thing that we haven't talked about that's obviously very closely linked to recruitment. There's no point bringing in a wonderful new diverse workforce that then wants to leave straight away because they're unhappy. But yeah, listening and genuinely doing something and being transparent about what you're doing is really important.
This is going to sound like a bit of a weird question, but how should an employer listen? Like, what? Like, if you, I think that I've kind of run workshops like on my product team where the team don't quite know each other, or maybe it's a bit dysfunctional, the relationship hasn't quite settled down, and you ask them a direct question and then it's kind of like tumbleweed silence. So I imagine if you're an employer and you're kind of at an all staff saying, how do you think we can improve, you might not get the interaction you're hoping for. What are some good ways of trying to listen to those views or collect them in the first place?
Yeah, I think the first two things spring to mind. The first one is go to wherever people are already telling you these things. So don't try and make a new forum or hold a new workshop or open a new form for people to fill in. People are probably already talking about what they're not happy about somewhere. So go and listen and be open in those spaces where people already are. And the second thing is, which I've worked in places that have put up a lot of resistance to this, is have an anonymous channel for people to speak directly to leadership. And that anonymity is really, really important to get the honesty that you need and to get around any trust issues you have, especially if there are already, if there's already some broken trust in the organization between from management down to people who are not management. Having an anonymous way of talking and asking questions and giving feedback can be really, really important. And there's always this fear of what will come through anonymously. And I think that's really unfounded and really blocks people from hearing some really important messages. And often people who don't feel safe or who don't feel confident or who feel like they might be discriminated against because if they ask what their genuine questions are non-anonymously, will feel much more comfortable doing that anonymously. Those are my two things. Yeah, listen where people are and have a way of asking anonymously.
So we've already talked about equitable recruitment and things that employers can do to try and improve their recruitment processes. For those people who are already inside any type of organisation, public or private, if they want to progress into senior roles, into senior leadership roles, are there specific things that organisations can do to support that? Because I'm thinking so often of not even necessarily the civil service, but other places where I've worked, where it seems actually you get a lot of us brown skinned people in on the sort of, you know, the first floor, but then the higher up the organisation you go, the few people seem to be retained, the few people make it to those higher echelons. And I'm wondering, like, is there something else that can be done?
This is such an interesting question to be talking about right now. I had a discussion last week with an amazing person who's working in a small group of three to develop a school for Black designers. And they've decided that their focus is going to be on how to get Black people higher up into different levels of public sector organizations. So it's strange that I'm having this conversation again. If you want to look up the work that they're doing, it's led by a woman called Teo Medupin. And I think if you Google Hello Brave School for Black Designers, you'll find the work they're doing. But they've sort of done some research and worked out that storytelling and helping underrepresented groups tell their stories and sell themselves is probably the most important thing. We have the skills, we are qualified, we are excellent at our jobs. So the theory behind the storytelling thing is that we're just not good at necessarily framing it in the way that the recruitment process wants to hear and that the more senior levels want to hear. I'm worried that it doesn't matter how good we get at storytelling, there's things at play in the system which mean that the underrepresented groups will just continue to be underrepresented because of the ways decisions are made and because of the sort of structural inequities built into the recruitment and promotion processes. But that's something that, you know, we have to hope that that's not true or that those things are being reduced over time. Things like bias. I mean, it's mostly unconscious bias, isn't it? And And I think also not being in those decision-making rooms and not knowing people already, I think your networks are really important. So maybe some other things that would be really great would be improving community and improving networking opportunities and improving kind of mentoring and things like that. We had an interesting series of talks when I was at GDS, Government Digital Service, where senior civil servants would talk to the rest of the organization about how they got into their role and sort of how they found doing that role. And what I noticed from those talks was so often it was, oh, I was chatting to another senior civil servant. I happened to have coffee with this man or this woman. My dad was friends with whoever. And those types of connections were what gave people the opportunities to be known and to get the roles and to get the skills needed to do the roles. And to be honest, I don't know how you replicate that for other groups that are underrepresented.
Well, I'm not saying I have the answer here or the DfE has the answer here, but within a month of me joining DfE, my line manager at the time said, would you like to go on a leadership course that's aimed at people of color? And I was in my head, I was like, no, I don't. no, actually, I do not. I think I politely said that. The main reason was because in a previous place I'd worked, I'd really thrown myself into like staff networks, co-chairing here, co-chairing there, and I was exhausted. And I was like, I don't want to, I can't do anything else. But when I read the sort of like blurb of what it was about, and the fact that my manager would be going through complementary training at the same time as me, I was like, okay, let me give this a bit of a look. I think it was called Power of Choice. I think it's like an external thing that comes into companies or whatever. But the reason I bring this up is because when you said you don't know how to replicate those conversations, I don't know how to replicate them either. But one thing that we were told to do in this kind of scheme was to work on VIC projects, VIC. And I'm going to completely forget what they all what those things meant now, what that acronym meant. But I think V was visibility. I was like impact, I think. It was impact or importance, but basically like a high impact, high importance. And C was complexity. So what they were saying was, you need to make sure you, after you finish this training course, you need to pick yourself out a VIC project. Have a look around your organization for where you might be able to help with something or lead on a project, and maybe speak to your line manager about how you might be able to create a VIC project if there's not an obvious candidate. And the idea was you were putting yourself out there on something that was, you know, valuable, visible, that had high impact and was complex, so that you would be seen by, you know, senior management to be doing something that was really valuable. And so they might not have had time to have a cup of tea with you. They might not knew you exist before that. But after they saw this VIC project, they'd be like, who is that? Who is that person over there? I am very impressed with them.
I totally get that. And I think that is probably a really good strategy for people who want to progress, who haven't been noticed. But the thing that worries me about that is that we're saying that the underrepresented groups need to work harder, work on more complex, more visible projects, have less choice. I mean, maybe I just want to do that quiet little project in the corner that nobody's noticing, but I can't. If I want to progress in my career, I have to go and do the highly visible, complex, noticeable one. So, you know, it's again putting the burden on the underrepresented groups to fix their career paths, you know, and learn something, do better.
Interesting.
Whereas if you're not in an underrepresented group, you've had the cup of coffee, you don't have to work on the VIC project because they've seen you, they've noticed you.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I wanted to come back to some facts and figures that have come out of DfE recently. With the first one being that in 2018, so not that long ago, the percentage of people from ethnic minority backgrounds was 17.2%, and now it's 19.6% in 2022. Now, the reason why I find that interesting is because the last public census that happened put like the amount of people of color or like ethnic minorities at 15%. So does that mean then, Clara, if we're almost 5% higher than the level in the UK as a population as a whole, does that mean our job's done? Does that mean we can now stop any active pushing and recruitment for people of color?
Sure, if you want us all to disappear again. I think what the point you raised earlier that people of color tend to be in the more junior roles, in the lower levels, find it harder to progress, find it harder to move up to senior decision-making places where they'll actually be able to make an impact and make a change. So if one of the things we're aiming for by having a diverse representation of people in the civil service is that it can impact the services we deliver and make those services more equitable, more just, better for the people out in the population, then the people inside the civil service need to be in roles where they can make that change and where they have an influence on those decisions. And if we're not getting there, if we're not happy in our roles, if we're not progressing, if we're not getting onto projects where we can make a difference or getting into positions where we can make a difference, then, you know, you can have as many percentage people as you like, but it doesn't make any change.
That's interesting, isn't it? Like, you're kind of suggesting that stats of, you know, how many ethnic minorities are interviewing, how many ethnic minorities work for your company, may actually be hiding a more systemic problem. That is, are the same people staying, and how far up in the organization are they going? Does that mean, do you think that perhaps any employers listening should think again about their sort of KPIs, take a look at whether they might be hiding other issues?
Yeah, definitely you need to look at what you're measuring and work out what needs to be measured. And probably you'll need to do that by talking to people of colour in your organisation and working out what's going on for them. If you've got 19% people of colour in your organisation, but 12% of those are on the verge of leaving because they're so unhappy, it's not a good statistic. So you need to work out what matters to them, what are the problems, what are the barriers they're facing, are they all burning out, are they spending all their time in the BAME networks, not getting recognised for all that extra work they're doing, so what's going on, and is it actually making a difference? And I think we probably need to start measuring outcomes of services, so what the outcomes are in the services that we deliver, and have a look at how that ties back to the makeup of the people who deliver and create the service. I think that's a really interesting thing that we haven't done enough of.
Wow. I've never even really thought about that before.
Because that's one of the aims of doing this, isn't it? We're trying to make our services better, not just make our organisations better, make the actual things we deliver better. So let's measure that and see if there's a correlation.
So as an example, product manager on at the moment is creating a new digital service for social worker assessment, something that is not coming at it from a sort of, are you meeting our standards, but it's more, how can we help you, how can we support you, that sort of thing. It's going to be this, it doesn't exist at the moment, it's going to be created. So how would your suggestion work then? Would we look at, I don't know, how many, I'm throwing out something crazy here, but how about looking at how many social workers from different sort of backgrounds are being retained, or?
Yeah, being retained, progressing. You could even look at, because the aim of the social worker's role is to support children and families, right? So, I mean, I haven't really worked in this domain. So you could look at the outcomes for different children and families with different demographics and see if changing the demographics of the social workers and the demographics of the people who deliver the service that you're working on, how that impacts through to children and families would be really interesting. So I can imagine, you know, if there was a Romani traveller family, they might have better outcomes if their social worker understood more about that, and if the people who developed the systems that the social workers are using or relying on understood more about that community, then that will have a better impact on those end users, the children and families at the other end. So it you know, it's kind of, we need to measure the impacts downstream and upstream. I don't know how you draw those connections because there's so many variables along that route.
I was just thinking, like, even for my small part of my small cog in the machine is looking specifically at, like, social worker assessments, but there must be so many other variables like pay or like working hours that contribute to it. But it's a fascinating conversation anyway. But let's move on for time then, Clara. So one other stat I wanted to throw your way was that the percentage of people of colour in the senior civil service, or rather I should say it the way they've written it, which is people from ethnic minority backgrounds, was 11.1% in March of this year, 2022, when we're recording. And the target set for next year is 13%. Now, that is below that 15% level of ethnic minority people backgrounds in the UK. So it's not reflecting as much as exists in the reality of the UK. However, what I believe is the case, and my producer Lou will let me know if I'm off the mark too much here, is that when they started measuring this back in 2015, it was 4%, 4%, went to 11%. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is sometimes you look ahead and you see the mountain that you have to climb. And I'm focusing this externally on employers who might be listening, thinking, we want to increase our numbers, but, you know, we don't know where to start and it looks terrible at the moment. But you can look at the mountain ahead, but then you can also turn around and look at, like, how far you've come in a short time. I don't think it's possible to go from 4% to 11.1% in a couple of years without concerted effort, without you attempting to deliberately make changes. So, yeah. I mean, what are your kind of thoughts about those figures, first of all?
I think that's great, and I think having figures can be really useful for people to keep them focused and to, you know, to measure your progress and to feel like you're doing something. It's not enough, because you can get distracted by those numbers. So you could focus on, you know, just getting that number as high as you can, as quickly as you can, and not worry about the experience that those people are having in your organization. And something that we used to remind ourselves of occasionally was that you might be doing harm to those people of color to bring them into an organization that is not there to, that can't support you. So, you know, you might be asking people to come into an organization where they're not safe, they're not supported, they're not going to be able to progress, they're not getting as much money as they could somewhere else, they're not getting the community they need to grow. So you need to make sure you're actually doing the right thing by those people that are boosting up those numbers for you.
That's so true. I think about, I grew up in Devon, which is, and I like to joke that in the 90s, my family was the black population of the town I grew up in. So, like, sometimes, I kid you not, I remember so many conversations started by well-meaning people who had never met a black person before. And so they were like, hey, I know someone in, you know, Exeter, and they're black. She's called Charlotte. Do you know her? And it was kind of like, it meant that at first I used to find it really irritating, but then I realized I am literally the ambassador for all black people in this moment. And how I react.
Why should you have to carry that?
Well, this is my point. My point is that sometimes you realize that's on you. And sometimes you're just tired of it being on you.
Yes.
And you're like, if I thought that I was joining an organization where that I was going to have to be the ambassador, I was going to have to be the pioneer. I would think twice about joining that organization, honestly.
Yeah, it's a huge burden.
And I don't, I guess I hadn't really thought about it that way until you said, trying to increase your numbers, just the numbers alone, might make you ignore or not even see other things that have to come along with the number boost. That's so fascinating. Clara, I could talk to you all day. Do you know what? That is literally all we have time for. Thank you so
Thank you so
much.
much, Jamie. That was lovely to chat to you.
What a lovely conversation. I really hope that you listeners have enjoyed it. I hope we haven't made you feel too uncomfortable, but if there's one thing you know about this show by now, it is that we don't stray away from the difficult conversations. No, indeed, we dive in head first. So, Clara Griot, if people do want to get in touch with you, where can they do that on the interwebs?
Mastodon. I'm on Mastodon at Clara GT.
Perfect. And listeners, if you would like to get hold of us, if you want to tell us what you thought, I'm saying this reluctantly, I don't know what people are going to think, but if you want to tell us what you thought, then Google our blog, DFE Digital Blog, and you'll find us with a DFE Digital and Technology blog. Or you can, I suppose you could try us on Twitter. It's DFE underscore digital tech. So this podcast was brought to you by the Department for Education. Thank you so much to our production team behind the scenes. And of course, thanks from me, your host, Adobe Fatshaw. Bye-bye.